probably till about 14. But when I was 13, on my 13th birthday, as a matter of fact, my youth minister came to my house. His name was Wes, and he came to my house and we talked, and we prayed. And that night, I accepted Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior. And I say it's very significant because that night was a real spiritual experience for me. And it was the first time I think I really felt okay with who I was. Before, I was always looking at other people trying to be like they were. My friends, I wanted Laurie's blue eyes or Becky's personality or Belinda's boyfriend. I mean, I wanted something that somebody had, and I did not feel right in my own skin. And starting that night, when I accepted Jesus Christ, I felt a peace for the first time that I had not felt. And I held on to that for about a year and a half until alcohol entered into my life, and that became my new master, and that became my everything. It became my new God. And when I it was right before I was 15, and I'm going to tell you, I drank alcoholically from the beginning. I mean, I don't know if I was an alcoholic in the beginning, but I certainly did drink alcoholically from the get-go. And my very first experience was, and I remember it like it was yesterday. Some people don't remember theirs. I remember mine until I passed out. But I was with my brother, had a keg party, and one of my friends said, she had tried drinking, and she said, just try it. If you can get past the horrible beer taste, if you can just get past that taste, you're going to feel something really cool. And man, she was right. And I don't know if it took me 2 beers or 10 beers, but when I started feeling that feeling of, oh my God, this is really what I've been looking for, I felt like now I've finally got that personality that Becky has. I've got those blue eyes, which I don't, that Laurie has. But it didn't matter because I had arrived. People liked me. I was the life of the party. And it completely changed me. And I was hooked from the get-go. And from that night, you know, I had a consequence of almost giving away my virginity, and would have had my brother not stepped in and stopped us, which I was ticked off for a lot of years. But because this guy I had a crush on, you know, since I was a kid. But anyway, so the next morning when I came to, and I was sick as a dog and dizzy and just really feeling horrible, my first thought was, oh my gosh, Kirk liked me. I got to get some more of that beer. You know, it definitely did something for me, and I knew I had to get some more beer. And I drank. It was very quick for me. Probably less than a year after that, I know I wasn't even 16, my mother was telling me that I was an alcoholic, and which devastated me. But I always tell this part of the story because it's kind of funny, but it tells the insanity of the disease. The day before she told me I was an alcoholic, I was alone in my house. My parents were gone to eat or what have you, and I needed to get the nerve up to call some guy that I had a crush on, yet another guy. And I looked in their liquor cabinet, and there was some gin, and I'd never drank the hard stuff before, so I knew you needed to mix it with something. I wasn't that stupid, so I liked Dr. Pepper, so I thought I would have some gin and Dr. Pepper, and proceeded to get wasted. And my, you know, parents came home, and I was just out of it. And the next morning, my mom's telling me I'm an alcoholic, and you know, and I was hurt and devastated, and I just thought to myself, I am never, ever, ever drinking Dr. Pepper again. and I meant it, and it's funny, but looking back, I can look at how I was serious about that, and I did not drink. It's like I got a bad batch of the Dr. Pepper, and I'm not going to risk that again. So I'll just lay off the Dr. Pepper, and I did not drink it for probably 5 or 6 years. So, yeah, I fell in love with alcohol, and I had loads of consequences, but I had tons of fun. And I was completely qualified to have a seat in these rooms at the age of 16, but I was nowhere near done. Nowhere near done. I'm going to fast forward. You know, I did go from, you know, really being a good kid, straight A, honor student, you know, cheerleader, just I would do everything my parents told me to. I went from that to very, very quickly being grounded, having locks on my door so I couldn't sneak out, which I would find a way to anyway, and barely graduating from high school. And I mean barely, from the skin of my teeth did I even graduate from high school. So, you know, fast forward, I just did a whole lot of partying. And again, a lot of it was fun. And married a guy, you know, that lasted about a year or whatever. And my first, I'll just fast forward to October of 1990. I'm on my second marriage. And this guy had three children that I helped raise, because I had to be an instant stepmom because their mother had died very, very young. And we had been married about 3 years, and he had enough of my drinking. It was bad influence on the kids. It was fine when it was just him and I because he thought it was fun, but when it was the kids were involved, it was bad influence. And he told me, "You're going to AA, or you know, or I'm leaving, or you're leaving, or I'm kicking you out." So my first meeting, AA, October 1990 in Dallas, Texas, and I just remember walking in, and I have no idea if they asked if there were any newcomers. If they did, I'm pretty sure I didn't raise my hand, because I've never been so scared in my life. I mean, I applaud these people who actually raise their hands when we ask for newcomers. Are you kidding me? You're going to admit that? Whatever. But I applaud that. I don't know how they had the courage to do that. I didn't. I just sat in the back, and I just remember people talking about gratitude. I remember people laughing. I also remember people talking about, you know, how they hid drinks from their husbands or whatever. It was an all-ladies meeting. And how they lied, how they cheated, and all that stuff I could relate to, but they're laughing in the middle of it. And then they're talking gratitude and crap, and I'm going, no. You people do not have the same problem I do. I'm certain of it. Or you wouldn't be laughing about it, because it's not funny. And it got around to this one lady, and again, I'll never forget it, because it's what got me back the next day. And all she said simply was, "I am just grateful that today I can look in the mirror and not hate myself." And I said to myself, "That's what I want. I want to not hate myself." I didn't even realize how much I hated myself until that lady said that. And that was enough to, you know, bring me to tears and have all these women crowd around me and you know, give me numbers, of which I don't even know if I ever called. I don't think I did. Gave me a desire chip. And I did not drink that night, which was the first time in years that I had not drank, that I had not snuck a drink. And I'm going to tell you, I went back and fell in love with you people and this fellowship. And I stayed dry on this fellowship, and I mean dry, because I was nowhere near sober for 2 years and 8 months. And there's a big, big difference, I would later find out, between being without alcohol and just without my solution than with a solution of God. And so we moved here to Nashville. I tried, I did try to hit a few meetings here. I think I tried 202, but man, they were really sick. And they were a lot sicker than my people in Dallas. So I just was not really quite like y'all. I could relate to the drinking thing, but this sponsorship, these 12 steps, y'all, those are for the sickos, and I'm not there. I'm just not one of you. And the truth was, I wasn't then. I wasn't. Those are those yets. And I just wasn't done. I'd nowhere near surrendered. So fast forward, of course, I'm going to start drinking. I did in June of 93, and finally in 2002, the same guy that pushed me into AA finally said, I've had enough and I'm divorcing, which was the second best thing he did. The first best thing was he introduced me to AA, and the second thing was he divorced me. Because that just got me to a little bit quicker bottom. When that happened, my first thought was, how can you leave all this? Are you kidding me? And then my second thought was, thank God I can finally drink like I want to drink. I don't have to hide a thing anymore. By God, I can drink whenever I want to and whatever I want to. And that's what I did. And I'm grateful for that. Somehow I did that for 5 years. And I found another sicko that was probably sicker than me, if that's possible, that drank every bit as bad as I did. And I drank myself to where I got to that point, and I understood this in the big book, where that jumping off point. I truly did not know. I did not know how I was going to live with it, and I did not know how I was going to live without it. I couldn't comprehend. There's nothing in between. What do I do? And I was dying inside. I was spiritually sick and dying inside. I'm not one of those who lost everything. I had a home. I had the same job that I have today, by God's grace. I had a car. I'd been to jail some here and there, but I had some things, but inside I was completely dead. And no matter how much alcohol, no matter how much alcohol I kept pouring in my body, I swear it would not fill that hole. And I'm sure a lot of you know what I'm talking about. So I always knew, even from when I was 13 and I accepted Christ, I knew that God was always going to be the answer to my problem, to all my problems if I let him. I always knew that, but I could never really get back to him. He never went anywhere, but I could not get back to him as long as alcohol was there, because it was always a step ahead of him. Here was alcohol, and here was God somewhere down here. But I didn't know how to get rid of the alcohol. And I was in prayer, because all this time in my active addiction, I never stopped praying, but it was the foxhole prayers. And this time I was in prayer, and I had kind of made a decision that what I was going to do was get a six-pack of beer, and I was going to detox myself. And because I didn't want to go through seizures. I'd already been through the real detox at outpatient about a year prior to that. I didn't want to go through seizures. I didn't want to go back to the hospital. So I was going to detox myself and slowly wean the alcohol off. And I got a six-pack of beer and was nursing it in my bedroom. And I probably drank four of them over a period of a day. And I called my daddy on a Saturday morning at 6 in the morning. And I just said, Daddy, I can't quit drinking. I've prayed and I've asked God to help me stop drinking, and I can't quit drinking. And he just simply asked me, Missy, have you been obedient? And I said, what do you mean? And he said, you can't just lay there and do anything. You can't just lay there and do nothing. That's not how God works. You have to get up and do something. And, he was not... He didn't know a thing about this program, but he knew God, and he knew that faith without works is dead. And I know now that that's exactly what he was telling me. And I know now that God was talking to me, using my daddy to talk to me. I have no doubt about that whatsoever. So I hung up from my dad, and it's not like, that I had the lightning bolt or a bunch of angels singing, oh, this is the answer. It wasn't like that. It was, I was still in really sick self-pity. And I finished the other two beers that I had. And I also finished the whatever mouthwash. I'd heard y'all, there's alcohol in mouthwash. I finished the mouthwash. whatever was in the condo, I was going to finish whatever alcohol was in that condo. And my very last my very last drink was a thing of green food coloring because I thought it was vanilla extract. And but that's what I was going to do, and that's what I did. And somehow, and I continued in prayer, and those words just kept coming back to me, and I had completely forgot that I'd written those words down that Daddy said, "Have you been obedient? You can't just lay there." And I wrote them down on a magazine. And he said a lot of other things, but that one stuck out. And what happened was that Sunday, or I'm sorry, Sunday I continued to drink that last little beer and the green food coloring. And Monday I came into Shade Tree. And I came in with a willingness and an open mind and desperation that I'd never had before. And I said, "I need help." And I finally realized that I had surrendered and conceded to my innermost self that I was alcoholic, that I was never, ever going to regain control of alcohol. Not that I ever really had it, but I knew that I was never going to. And I came in and I said, "I need help. I can't do this." And I had bounced in and out of Shade Tree a number of times, and y'all said the same thing you always did. Get a sponsor, start working the steps. And this time, instead of me going, "No, thanks anyway," I said, "Okay." And I picked the first girl I could find in that meeting. Her name was Nora. And from that moment on, since I truly surrendered, you know, we were just talking outside, and a lady and I were just talking outside, and we were saying how I'd almost like to rewrite the first step, because I could easily admit that I was alcoholic. Admitting was not a problem. Accepting that I was alcoholic, that was the big difference for me, and I'd finally accepted and conceded. And so that there came the willingness, and so I started getting busy, and I started working the steps, and I started doing some service work that was requested and required, and you know, for this alcoholic. I started getting a relationship, gaining that relationship back with God that I'd walked away from so many years ago. I was just thinking, you know, what it's like now, there is no comparison. But another sponsee of mine, we were talking just the other day, we were doing some step work, and she said, "You know that saying that we have in the rooms, don't quit before the miracle happens?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Missy, what is the miracle?" I said, "Dang, that's a really good question. Let me call my sponsor." No. I said, "That's a really good question." And I said, "You know, be honest with you, it's not for me. There is not just the miracle. There are tons of miracles. There are tons of miracles that I recognize today that have happened in my life. You know, the miracle is that I finally surrendered to this sick disease, this deadly, fatal disease. And I asked for help. And the miracle is, three weeks after I picked up that last desire chip and I found out my daddy had 3 months to live because he was just diagnosed with terminal cancer, the miracle is I didn't pick up a drink. I didn't have to pick up a drink. I started reaching out to the few people I knew in these rooms, and I got back to knowing a God that was going to carry me through that experience and let me know a peace and serenity that I had never experienced before, even in the worst time of my life. That's a freaking miracle. You know, and the miracle is that, dang, I was, you know, able to sit there and help my mama and my brothers through that time and do something for somebody else instead of thinking me for change. And the miracle is that I get to work with girls and see the changes and the miracles that happen in their lives. And, you know, And the miracle is that God put somebody in my life early on in recovery that I could fall in love with and marry. And I'm so blessed that he knows and loves God every bit as much as I do, and I believe puts him first in his life and the head of our union. That's a miracle. And y'all may think these are just, you know, just good things that happen, or just little blessings or little gifts, and you can call them whatever you want. I call them miracles because I know the person I was before I walked in here. And I know how sick and sad and selfish I was and dying from this disease I was when I walked in here. And I'm going to tell you something. There is no resemblance of that person today. And I'm crying and I'm emotional for different reasons today than I was when I walked in here. Because these are tears of happiness and joy, not sadness and despair. There's a big difference. And I guess if, and I'm going to let Mikey speak. I guess the if there's any message out tonight is sometimes I think we take these miracles for granted. I shouldn't say we. I do. For anybody who's new or struggling with this disease, the miracle is you can have all of this and more if you just start getting busy. If you surrender and start getting busy and getting to know a God who will provide all you will ever need. And the miracle for me today, and I think for a lot of you in here, that I take for granted sometimes, I'm ashamed to say, is that I've gone a day today without even the thought of picking up a drink. That's a miracle. Thank you, Yet Group, for letting me share, and especially for Mike Huffman for letting me share the podium with him tonight. My dear friend, I'm letting you get up here and share your story.
Mr. Mike H. is going to talk now.
Hi, everybody. I'm Mike, alcoholic.
Hi, Mike.
Thanks, Missy. That's good stuff. I have a lot of the same things in my life. We're both alcoholic, that's for sure. She's T for Texas. I was born in Tennessee, Nashville, 1964 at St. Thomas Hospital. I had two parents that were married for 54 years. Neither one of them were alcoholic. I have a brother and a sister. Neither one of them alcoholic. Both of them younger than me. I have 26 cousins on one side and four on the other side, none of them alcoholic. Aunts and uncles, you know, they might get drunk on the holidays and stumble up the steps. The people I know that drink can buy a half gallon and it lasts them a month or two. So I have a lot of relatives, and I'm the one that started drinking when I was 17 and was blacking out by the time I was 19. And getting DUIs by the time I was 20. I made a wreck of my life. I got married early. I went to college and made a drunken mess of that. And I came home, went to work, and married a local girl. And we had a daughter. Her name's Haley. She's very important to me. And I truly, you know, drank too much and had some blackouts up to this point. But about 2.5 years into our marriage, I came home from a business trip to Memphis, and my house was empty, my daughter was gone. And the first time in my life, I went to the liquor store, and I didn't know it then, but I know it now, I was medicating. I bought a fifth of Jack Daniels, and I went home. I had one TV, a recliner, and my clothes were sitting in the floor, the washer and dryer were gone. Everything I'd worked for was gone, my kid was gone, they wouldn't even let me see her at the daycare, so I went home and drank whiskey straight for the first time. It took me about an hour to where I couldn't get out of the chair. And that's the first time I ever remember just sitting down to get bombed. And the other times it just snuck up on me because two or three beers needed to be five or six. But and that was the first time I ever remember, you know, waking up wondering what the hell am I going to do with my life? And what I didn't do is I didn't turn to God. I didn't turn to family. I turned into a hateful, resentful, selfish, self-centered person that drank first and did the rest of my life second. And I didn't just go into terrible drinking fits. For about the first 5 or 6 years, until my daughter was 10, 9 years old, I was a really good weekend dad. I picked her up, never late. We went to softball games. I coached her teams. We did that stuff. And on the other weekend when I didn't have her, I partied. And lots of alcohol and drugs, too. And in an 11-year period, I sent a 77 GMC, an 80 model Corvette, and an 87 Toyota four-wheel drive to the junkyard. I spent 30 days in Vanderbilt Hospital one time. They picked me up out of the median when I flipped my Toyota, and they were going to the morgue, and I started breathing. So they went to Vanderbilt. And a lot of us have that same story. For 10 years I did this reckless living and started making enemies and getting a lengthy police record, not just DUIs, but assaults and public drunks and things like that. And I started, like Missy said, I didn't know it, but I hated me. I had destroyed myself. It wasn't supposed to be this way. The way I grew up, I was supposed to be somebody. Everybody else was. I had no reason to be an alcoholic. When I was a kid, I could come home from school, and in 10 minutes, I could be hunting or fishing. We lived out by the lake. It was very rural. All my first jobs, I had to ride a bicycle too. I was always a good worker, always made good money. I could work hungover. I could pay attorneys. I could pay judge fees and court costs, get myself off probation, and mess it up again. But the last 3 months of 9 months of 1999, I was hospitalized 3 times for alcohol poisoning, and I was in the middle of my 4th DUI, and I was trying to manage my life. I couldn't keep a job. I became unemployable, and the third time I left the hospital, I went to a halfway house, and that was in 2000, and I began to, it was a horrible thing for me to look at myself in the mirror. And the very first day that I got there from the hospital, I had like $70 on me, and I had some tools and I had some clothes, and that's all I had. Everything else was gone. I couldn't get to it if it was a lot, you know. And so the guy that owned the halfway house says, I gave him the money I had for rent, and he said, in the morning you get up, you walk up to day labor at 4 o'clock, you'd be the first one in the door, and you beg them for a job. So that's what I did. I started taking suggestions. And I worked that first day. I went to a construction site. I ran a shovel and picked up trash. I got back. I was gone from the house for like 11 hours, and I came home with a check for $38. And I had been accustomed to making a lot more money than that. So it was very humbling. And I didn't know it then, but God was working on me. And I wasn't open to letting God fix my life yet, because I'd had a very religious life as a kid, and I had a relationship with God. I was involved in the church, and I was a really good kid. I made real good grades. I went to college, straight into engineering school. I got accepted to UCLA. You know, I couldn't afford to go there, but I got accepted. And As I was in this halfway house, I realized what a mess I'd made of my life. So I began to take suggestions. And I was told that the harder I work and the more things I do to help somebody else, the less I'll worry about me. So I began to go to meetings early and make coffee and work with my sponsor as long as he would. And I stayed sober for a while. And I was coming up on my final DUI charges, and I left the halfway house, and I got drunk, and I got that extended, and I got back in the halfway house. And then I went to jail from the halfway house. And when I got out of jail, James had me back, because I went into jail sober, and I stayed sober in the jail. And that wasn't so easy, because you can get high and drunk in jail if you want to. But anyway, so I came out of jail, and I had a comfortable place to live, and I had made a phone call a few weeks before I got out to a guy who owned a mechanic shop here in Donelson, and I told him what was going on, and he knew what I could do with cars, but he also knew what I could do with a bottle. But he trusted me. He needed some help. So he hired me at, like, very small wage, and I got a ride from Madison to Donelson every day, and I started making amends. I like the way Liston says how long it took him to make amends. Financial amends were important to me. I owed the state of Tennessee $10,000, owed my ex-wife $8,000, and various and sundry other things, and I had no driver's license. But I had a meager job, so I ate hot dogs, potatoes, rice, and beans, and paid my bills best I could, because I don't like debt too well. And the time all this was going on, my daughter and I had a great relationship up until about age 11 for her. And then between age 10 and 14 or so, if I talked to her, she came and visited, and I saw her, and she, you know, she was kind, but I could tell on the other end of the phone she really didn't want to talk to me. Hi, Dad, you know. She was anxious to get off the phone. And so I decided I was, you know, so I did the next right thing, and I got out of the halfway house, and I had paid most of that debt off. And I was working over here at the shop where I work now, and I was working for my brother, and I was 2 years and a few months sober in 2005. And I was coming to this meeting, and I was working with Joe V as a sponsor, and I quit calling Joe. I quit going to meetings, and in about 90 days, I was sick, and I got drunk in August of 2005. And I called Joe that Monday, and Joe and I talked for a few minutes, and he said, "Well, Mike, you need a new sponsor. You need to do something different." And I was a mess. I was a crying wreck, because I drank for 3 weekends in a row, and I thought I was going to lose my job, and I thought I was going to lose everything. What I did is I lost me. And I learned on that relapse that when I take a drink, it cuts me off from the sunlight of the Spirit. Like Missy said, when she was drinking, she couldn't get to God. Neither could I. When I quit talking to God, the alcohol bled back in, and as soon as I drank, God had no place in my life, because I became selfish, self-centered, and I didn't want to feel what was going on out here. So anyway, that day, it was a Monday, August 28th, 10 years ago, I called Walter, and I said, "Man," and I was bawling. I don't remember much what I said, but I said, "I need a sponsor." He said, "Are you at work?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Can you not drink for an hour?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "I'll be there." So he picked me up about 4 o'clock that afternoon, and my little brother let me go early because he wanted me sober too. All my family wanted me sober. And we went over to Fat Bites, and we drank coffee, and we had a big book and a meditation book. In about 3 or 4 hours, and I don't remember much of what I said or what he said. I remember I cried a lot. And I think, when I reminisce about it, I think there was some stuff in my fifth step or something I needed to tell somebody that got out. And when we were done, I was not hysterical anymore, but I didn't have a sense of peace. But the next morning when I woke up, I had a sense of peace that everything was going to be all right. And for the first time in my life, the little man back here, that I like to call the little man back here, wasn't talking to me. He wasn't telling me, "Mike, someday you'll be a normal drinker." Because even, you know, I got 3 1-year chips in 11 years in the 90s coming around here. But the little man always would say, "It's okay, you do your AA thing, you get your chips, and you go make coffee, but you'll drink again. There'll be a time when you'll be fixed." And that little man's been quiet for 10 years. And the only thing different was God, and I did more and more service work. I learned... And I learned this before I relapsed. This is a story that a lot of my groups told, but I was living at the halfway house, and we had 9 meetings a week we had to go to. And I went over to the old Lakewood meeting, a lot of old-timers. And I'd stand out until I heard them reading how it works, and I'd throw my cigarette away, and I'd go in. And as soon as the Our Father was done, man, I was out the door. And we did that. I don't know. I went over 30 or 40 days, and one day I was standing there. We said the Our Father, and I headed out, and somebody grabbed me real firm on my right shoulder. I looked around, and it was old Jim Rowe, who's not in Nashville anymore. And Jim Rowe said, "Come here, boy. Let me show you how we clean coffee pots." And I was fixing to say, "You old man, I'm not fixing to clean these coffee pots." But I didn't. I cleaned them. And I didn't get halfway through, and I started smiling, started enjoying it. He showed me, they showed me that Service Works makes them happy. Roy, who's passed away now, and Joe Villa, they took me to fish fries. They took me to cookouts. "Here, put this spatula, get this apron on, take this trash out, empty these ashtrays, set up some..." And when I would call the guys at the halfway house, I would tell them what I'm doing. And they were like, "Yeah, we have to do that shit too." But I wasn't hating it anymore. I was doing what God wanted me to do, or at least what I thought he wanted me to do, be helpful. When I was in the hospital one time over at Tennessee Christian Medical Center, they had a Sunday meeting. And I don't know which time, because I was in there 3 times in 9 months. I came down to this Sunday meeting, and I think they'd just given me a Valium because I was a shaker when I got so drunk. It took me a couple days to get off that. And there was a man named 449 Joe, Joe C. He passed away about 9 months ago or so. He was from the Madison Goodlettsville side. And he came down to this meeting, and there was about, I don't know, 6 or 8 of us patients and 5 or 6 people from the outside, and Joe was chairing the meeting. And he said, "I'm Joe C., and I'm here on a Sunday to introduce y'all to AA. If you're in the hospital here, you're pretty sick from drugs and alcohol. I got the cure." He said, "But I just want you to know my job's not to cure you. My job's to love people." And that man, all he ever talked about is loving people. And he always did for people. And when he showed up at a meeting, if somebody didn't get out and come in with him, it was odd. Rarely did he come by himself to a meeting. I bet you know Joe. But he was impressive on me. And then when it came to the living one day at a time thing, I had a problem with that because I wanted to plan this and plan that, and I wanted to fix my past. And at that Lakewood meeting, there was an old man that's still around named Vester Bradshaw. And Vester Bradshaw one time was talking about living one day at a time, and he said, "Man, I just look at it as like going to the mailbox and getting my envelope from God. I get up in the morning, I open my envelope, and if all the instructions aren't there, they'll be given to me later." And I thought, how damn simple is that? I'm worrying about tomorrow and Friday, and it's only Tuesday. And all that stuff is that Missy said is so true. She kind of told my story. But this is today's meditation for today, if I can get these on. And I thought it was appropriate to read because happiness is what I never had. And this is about happiness, and it's about service work. And it says, "Happiness cannot be sought directly. It is a byproduct of love and service. Service is a law of our being. With love in your heart, there is always some service to other people. A life of power and joy and satisfaction is built on love and service. Persons who hate or are selfish are going against the law of their own being. They are cutting themselves off from God and other people. Little acts of love and encouragement, of self and help, erase the rough places of life and help make the path smooth. If we do these things, we cannot help but have our share of happiness." So when I get sponsors that just, "This sucks, I hate it, I'm unhappy," I suggest service work. And I got one, I've sponsored some guys all the way through the steps before. And I know of one that's still sober. And we get to pass on our service work. And when I had just moved over here and was working and living in Bluefields and riding a bike to work, because I didn't have a driver's license for 8 years, and I never, ever missed being somewhere I was supposed to be. And I'm a hard ass. I don't have sympathy for people without driver's license. When they say, I can't get a job because I don't have a driver's license. I got a job and bought my own business with no driver's license. And anybody can if they let God help them. But anyway, what I was talking about service work is, and Larry called me, and he was working the jails every Tuesday night, and he didn't have much help. He said, man, you want to go to the jail? I said, man, if you pick me up, I'll go to a meeting with you. So we went. And we went, and we went. And while I was in jail, this guy named Owen was a hateful, resentful alcoholic. He had 3 DUIs, but he wasn't no damn alcoholic. And Owen was in jail for about 90 days, and we saw him every week. And I built a relationship with him, and he left out of jail. And there are no coincidences, because I was dating Stacy, and we had gone to the Titans game, a preseason game. And we're walking out during the third quarter because the scrubs are in. And I hear this guy say, hey, Mike. I look up, and it's Owen. And he looks good, but and he's with some people, but you can tell he's sober. But you can tell he's looking crazy. I just remember that look he had. He looked like, hey, Mike. And he's got this life, and then here I am, you know. And I know he wants what I got. I can tell it, but he ain't ready to ask for it. So I give him my card, and I give him a number. 3 days later, I'm at work, about 3 o'clock. Phone rings, and he got home from work, and this person he lived with did that, and I can't do it anymore. And I did what Walter did. I said, can you not drink for an hour, and will you go to the halfway house? He said, man, I'll do anything because I'm this close to a drink. I said, don't drink for an hour. By then, I had a driver's license. So I drove over there, and I took this guy to the halfway house, and he took my suggestions for a long time. And then when he got out of the jail, he went with jail to us. And he does service work. He chairs a meeting over in Madison now. It's over in Englewood. And I used to go there. I should know the name of it. But passing it along and making suggestions and watching people follow them. And people, like Missy said, I mean, people, I can tell. There's been a few that have talked to me about sponsoring. And I can tell they want what I got. And one of the first questions is, are you willing to do what I did? You know, and then I tell the story about I walked in the November rain and ran a shovel for $38 a day. Are you willing to do that? And some people aren't. You know, a lot of us don't get to stand up here and have 10 years of sobriety and a great, wonderful, happy life. A lot of us die because this is a deadly disease. And I'm sure glad for the Yet Group, Missy Barnes, and every one of y'all in here. Thanks for letting me talk.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil.